session number 24609, reel 3.
On the ground, and he was a very good RSM. During my stay in Burlington, I really got to like him. Sounds kind of crazy when you begin to like an RSM, but that's exactly what happened. He had a disfigurement in his face. He was a boxer in the army for many years, and he'd had a broken jaw, and it hadn't set properly, and he ended up with what looked like a permanent smile on his face. Well, as soon as he came out on the veranda of the office, one of the guys that were waiting to be interviewed, he smiled back at him, what he thought was a smile. And Collett says, "Oh, you think it's funny? Okay, Corporal, run them around the square." So we were running around the square a few times. When we came back, nobody smiled at RSM Collett anymore. I rapidly settled down in Bovington. This was the time of the Berlin airlift, and everything was very scarce. Things were being shipped into Berlin by plane. Coal was very scarce. We were rationed to 1 pound of coal per man per week, which wouldn't exactly blow you out of the hut with the heat. I had two very good friends that I'd made as soon as I arrived in the camp. One was Jock Blackwood, and the other was Taffy Doolan. One a Scot, and the other a Welshman. We got along really well together. The three of us were sort of inseparable. We began to consider what we're going to do about this coal problem. We didn't have any coal to keep ourselves warm at night, and these barracks were not very warm. They were the wooden huts, and they let in the draft and everything like that. So we were out scouting around the camp at about 2 o'clock one morning, and we wandered down to the Armor Corps Depot. Going through the Armor Corps Depot, we came across a big compound surrounded by corrugated iron fence, about 8-10 feet tall. We managed to get to the top of this fence with the help of some oil barrels that we stood on. We saw with our surprise that the compound was full of coal. So we went back to our quarters and got three kit bags, one apiece, went back, got into this compound, filled them up with coal, went back to the hut. The hut had a hatch in the ceiling that led up into a small loft. So we put the coal up there overnight and during the day. The following evening, we got the coal down and we started a big fire in our fireplace. We got our beds and made a semicircle around the fire. Soon the guys next door and the guys all around us were banging on the door. They could see the flames coming out the top of the chimney. They wanted to come in for a warm-up. So Jock, Taffy, and I decided that it was worth two cigarettes for 15 minutes. So this is what we did. We Mm-hmm. One of us would be on the door collecting the cigarettes. The other two would be directing people where to sit. You went to the back of the room and you gradually worked your way to the front as your time came up. And so we made all our cigarette ration from this incident. The workshop itself was down in a little hollow as you're going out of the town towards the tank training grounds. It's been well over 50 years since I was at Arlington, so my memory is kind of clouded to exactly the physical layout of the camp. But we used to march down to the workshops in the morning. The Centurion tanks were being processed for gun stabilizers by the civilian scientists, and we weren't allowed anywhere near the Centurion tanks, but there was one little incident that got back to us. Apparently one of the Centurions were taken down to Lowworth Cove, which was one of the places they used to do the water testing for vehicles, and apparently one of the tanks got stuck in the sand, and the tide came in, and there was a big flap that they had to leave this tank for overnight, and they put a heavy guard around it, and the following day they went down with Scammel tank transporters and winches, and they set off small explosive charges under the tracks to jar it loose, and then winched it out. So that solved their little problem. When we went to work in the workshops, the vehicles were mostly older trucks that date back to, some of them, to the early 30s, I guess, the late 20s. I know there was a Leyland truck. I can't remember the name. It wasn't the Retriever, but it was a four-cylinder side valve engine. It was a very crude affair. It was the cab was canvas covered, with a canvas lid on it, and we had quite a few of these there that had to be taken apart. Most of them came from North Africa and were painted sort of desert colors. But we were always looking for some way to play a practical joke on somebody. And of the civilian mechanics that were there was one called Dusty Miller. And he was quite a character in himself. In the afternoon, he liked to get on one of the rolling creepers, get under a truck with a couple wrenches, and catch up on his sleep. So one day we waited until Dusty was sound asleep, and we got in the truck and we took the emergency brake off and rolled the truck back from over on top of it and parked the truck somewhere else, leaving Dusty lying in the middle of the workshop floor asleep. Well, when he finally woke up, he went nuts, chasing us around the workshops with a broom and cussing us. But we always enjoyed a good laugh, and like most military people, we enjoyed playing practical jokes and having a bit of excitement in our lives. So that was our experience in the workshops at Bovington. I did several courses while I was there. I did one on diesel, one on waterproofing vehicles for beach landings, and I've done another on tank recovery, the use of winches and the power you can exert dragging a tank. So I began to get my sort of life together and began to get these courses under my belt. And I became a vehicle mechanic, class two, and then one eventful day I was reading orders, and I was on there to go to the guards depot at Caterham for a course in drill instructor. Well, I didn't want to be no drill instructor. I was a vehicle mechanic, and I couldn't understand why they were going to send me to learn to be a drill instructor. So I was quite perturbed about this, and I went into the office, and I talked to one of the girls that I knew there, and said, could you get me out of this camp in a hurry? So she pulled a few strings and made a few inquiries. Next thing you know, I was up on orders again to go to Singapore. So this is not exactly what I had in mind. I had a transfer to a camp near one of the big cities in England. But I accepted this, and I was given a rail warrant and 10 days leave and sent home. And on completion of my leave, to report to Harbourfield for draft to Singapore. I went home and I had a good time with my buddies and said goodbye to my family and my brother. My brother was still in school, of course. And when the leave was up, I made my way to Arborfield. Arriving at Arborfield, we were designated a code letters for our draft, which was DLOMA. This was stenciled on our kit bags and our gear, and we were told to draw tropical kit. We drew tropical kit, and then we had to wait for a troop ship to take us out to Singapore. The wait went into several weeks, I believe. I can't recall exactly the space of time, but it seemed like a long time to us. Because we were confined to camp, we couldn't go outside the camp at all. So a friend of mine that I made in Arborfield at the time, we decided to jump the fence and go AWOL for the weekend. So we went to the back of the camp, and we found a spot on the fence that was kind of isolated. We climbed the fence and got over. As soon as we got to the other side of the fence, it started to rain, and we had a plowed field to walk through. When we got to the other side, we were in quite a mess, mud up to our knees. We started walking down the main road, and we came upon a little cafe with a little old lady. She was quite disturbed to see the state we were in, and told us to come in and go in the back room. And I can't remember whether she had us take our uniforms off or what, but I know she sponged the mud off our pants and got us cleaned up and looked reasonably respectable. And we stayed there for quite a while and had tea and muffins, I guess, or some kind of biscuits. And then when we left there, this buddy of mine and myself, we split up. He went on to London, where he lived, and I went to Great Bookham in Surrey, where my aunt and uncle lived with their two kids, Sylvia and Alistair, which were a bit younger than me. So I spent a very enjoyable week end with my aunt and uncle, my cousins. And then on the Sunday, I had to make my way back to Harborfield. So when I got back to Harborfield, I decided that I'm not going to go back over the fence again. I'm going to walk right up to the main gate. So I did. I walked up to the main gate. The guard wanted to know what I was doing on that side of the fence. So he let me in and took me into the guard room. And I was all ready for a real sort of going over and the charges against me and things like that. But I had a bottle of rum in my greatcoat pocket. And what finally happened was I finished the night by playing cards with the guard commander and some of the guard. And I can't remember whether I won any money or no, but I know at the early hours of the morning, the guard commander said, "Well, you know, it's time for you to head out." He sent me back to my quarters and everything was forgotten. He said, "You know, keep it quiet, don't say anything to anybody, but, you know, you could be charged with being AWOL." So I got away with that. Eventually, we were allocated a ship to take us to Singapore. It was the Genera, the sister ship of the Delwara. So one bright sunny day, we were shipped by train down to Southampton. And the usual, in usual military fashion, hurry up and wait kind of thing, where it took ages to get on the ship. And then we all leaning over the side of the ship, watching the band down below and all the guys' relatives and things like that. Eventually we got underway and the Genera went out around the Isle of Wight and into the English Channel, across the channel to the French coast, and then down to the Bay of Biscay. It was early in the morning that we hit a terrific storm, 100 mile an hour winds and gales, and the ship was being tossed around like a cork in the water. The staff sergeant came up to me and my buddy, said, "You're going to be on picket duty between 2 and 4 in the morning." And I said, for what? You know, and he said, "Well, according to military regulations, a troop ship is a military establishment, and it has to be guarded at all times. And you're selected for picket duty to walk around the decks for 2 hours." So they issued us with the sou'wester, the yellow oilskins, and the hat, and they gave us a pickaxe handle and told us to go around the deck. And I said, "Well, what's the pickaxe handle for?" They said, "That is to repel boarders." I said, "What boarders? You know, we're in the middle of one of the biggest storms of the century, and the boat's being tossed around like a cork." I said, "Who's going to want to get on the ship?" "Well, this is regulations. We gotta perform this picket duty." So this friend of mine and myself, we braced ourselves and we went on deck. It was a howling gale. You could hardly stand. The crew had put a rope around the decks to hold on to. And we would face the bow and watched while the bow went down into the trough of water. And as soon as the bow started to lift, the water would pour down the decks about waist high, and we'd hang on for dear life to prevent ourselves from being washed overboard. And then as the ship came up out of the waves, we'd pull ourselves up by the rope a few feet and wait for the next wave to break over the deck. It took us 2 hours to go around the whole ship. And when we got back, I was kind of mad, you know, to think that our lives were put at risk. We could have been washed overboard very easily. And just for the sake of complying with military tradition, all the troop ships had to be picketed at all times. So we made it through this storm through the Bay of Biscay and down to Gibraltar, where we stopped and let off some troops and picked up some troops. And then the next part of the voyage was to Tripoli in North Africa to do the same thing, to pick up and deposit troops. And then across the Mediterranean, where we had another storm at night. At that time, it was quite warm, and we were sleeping on decks, hid away from the foul smells below decks. And I was fortunate. I had my blanket wrapped around me, but a wave broke over the bow during this storm and washed a lot of the blankets at the guys were covered with, washed them over the side. I was fortunate I hung on to mine. We finally made it to Port Said, and we went ashore for a brief period while big floodlights were fitted to the bow, the Deneira, to go down through the Suez Canal. We made the trip through the Suez Canal during daylight hours. And it was quite interesting watching the Arabs taking their produce to market by donkey or camel. And this was all new to us, of course, being the first time out of England. We got down through the Bitter Lakes and into the Red Sea. The first thing that happened in the Red Sea was that we hit a sandbar. We bent one of the propeller shafts, and we were spent the rest of the time down to Aden on one engine. We got to Aden, where the rumor was that we were going to be repaired, going to stay there for a while to get repairs done. This was not true. We stayed at Aden long enough to drop off and pick up troops. And then we started across the Indian Ocean. It took us 2 weeks to cross the Indian Ocean, which should have only took us about 5 or 6 days, I guess. And we didn't see land for almost 2 weeks. We finally got to the other side of the Indian Ocean and started going down the coast of Malaya, between Malaya and I believe it's Sumatra, and eventually arrived in Singapore Harbor. After that spell across the Indian Ocean, it was good to see some kind of life other than life on the troop ship. We spent most of our time leaning over the bows of the ship, watching the dolphins cutting across the bow of the ship, and also watching the flying fish. The flying fish would be leaping and jumping all over the place. When we got to Singapore, which is a very impressive harbor, we took forever, of course, to get off the ship. When we finally did, which I believe was getting quite late in the afternoon, we were put on trucks and shipped to Nee Soon camp which was a sort of reception area for troops. We stayed there overnight, and then a truck took us up to the into Malaya and across the causeway into Johor Bahru, the southernmost city in Malaya, town in Malaya, and then about 5 miles, 6 miles north to a little outpost called Pandan Tabrau. This was to be our home for 2 years. It was 221 Vehicle Battalion, REMI, LAD, attached to the Royal Army Ordnance Corps. The camp itself was encompassed on three sides. By one side, the river, a sort of a tropical jungle-type river. On the other side was swamps and jungle. And on the other side was the road and the village. He got into the workshop. It was a high, about 10-foot-high, double fence around, with about a 4-foot space in between the two fences. That was kept clear by civilian laborers. We got inside. There was a small courtyard in front of the office. The office was a concrete building with a flat roof with about 4 or 5 rooms in it. On top was a wooden hut that was built to accommodate the guys that lived there. We stood outside the office for a while, and eventually it was my turn to go in for an interview with the CO. A CSM Wilson, Tug Wilson, took me in to see the CO, marched me in, smart salute, and the CO turned out to be a Captain Newlove, Arthur Newlove. The adjutant was sitting beside him, was a Captain Cooper, Percy Cooper. I stood in front of his desk and saluted smartly, and he said, sort of relaxed, you know, we're all kind of friends here, which kind of surprised me. There wasn't the usual official attitude. And they asked me what I was, vehicle mechanic, and oh, okay, fine. And they dismissed me, and I went out, and was assigned to share a room up above the office. There was a wooden staircase going up the side that you went up, and there was about 4 or 5 small rooms up there. And I was assigned to one of these rooms. The temperature, of course, and the humidity was very high in Malaya. It took us a little bit of time to get used to that. The constant sweating and constant having to shower 3 or 4 times a day. But we settled in, and it turned out that there were 8 of us in the camp, not including the CSM and the 3 officers. There was Captain Newlove, Captain Cooper, and a lieutenant. I can't think of his name now, but we were on our own. At night, the officers and the CSM would be taken to their married quarters, and we would be on our own. At that time, of course, the terrorist campaign was in full swing in Malaya, and after dark, we were confined to camp. We weren't allowed out. There were patrols out at night looking for these terrorists. So we had to stay in the camp. The people there was two guys that I got very friendly with. One was Norman Hayes, Norman Gabby Hayes, we used to call him. And another was Alan Wise, we used to call him Wizzy, Wizzy Wise. Then there was an Australian fellow called